welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 25th of April 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week. It's a glorious sunny day where I am, and we're here today to discuss the week's news and get into our greatest Britons with Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? What's it like where you are?
It's been a beautiful weekend. We've had sunshine, and I've been enjoying the sunshine, really getting out and cycling and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's nice to get a bit of a tan, isn't it? Of course, we're now hearing that the people trying to break into our country, they might be given a little holiday somewhere where they can get a bit of a tan as well. This is the news that the asylum seekers that have been coming in across the channel are no longer going to be put up in hotels at the taxpayers' expense, but they're actually going to be taken off to Rwanda, where their asylum claims will be processed. And if they qualify for asylum, then they can have asylum in Rwanda. And this is hoped that it will put them off from actually coming across and making this crossing in the first place. And I talked about this a little bit last week, and the way that I look at it is we have to find a solution that is equitable to everyone. The people that are coming over, they're claiming asylum. They're claiming they want to be safe from bombs or political persecution. And if we put them in Rwanda, they are safe from bombs and political persecution. They'll be under British law there. We also have to do what's right for the British people, the indigenous British people. And the more people that come over from France, the more there are waiting lists at the hospitals, the more there are waiting lists at the schools, the more queues there are. There's also an increase in crime when you have multiculturalism, because there's more potential victims that are from other extended families to your own. Not saying that one particular group is more crime prone than any other, but even if all the groups were just exactly had the same criminality, there would still be more potential victims there, because there are members of all these different extended families around. It's much easier to carry out a crime against somebody that's not a part of your own family. So we've got all these reasons why it's not good to have this unlimited immigration, and I think we've got a solution there that is of benefit to the British people, and it's of benefit to the people that are coming over, because they do get their safety from political persecution and whatsoever, and it's a very sensible idea, and we've been talking about this for ages. But will they actually do it? That is the question. Mark Collette, I think, did a video this week where he was putting doubt on this, that he doubts whether the British government are actually going to do this. What are your thoughts on it, Max? Do you think they're actually going to go ahead and do this, or do you think it's just bluff?
Well, there are people who are civil servants who've publicly stated that they think that the scheme is iniquitous, that they're not going to take part in it. A number of people have threatened that they're going to resign. I think some people have actually resigned their positions rather than be the people that implement this. And they've been claiming that it's kind of like sending people off to Auschwitz. They've used those kind of comparisons as sending people off to Rwanda, which is quite insulting to the people of Rwanda. And from the TV footage that I've seen of the country, it looks quite a pleasant place to live, and the hotel that is the first hotel that's going to be used to house the people that are sent over there looks like a very pleasant place to stay. Actually, I think that if you were thinking of holidaying Africa, that is the sort of place that you might actually book as a place to go and stay in. So I don't think people believe that it's a horrendous place to go to. The main grounds for claiming that it's a horrendous place was the war that took place, and the genocide between the Hutus and the Tutsis, which I think took place something like about 25 years ago. And to turn around and say, oh, well, I'm not going to Rwanda because it's a place where genocide took place, is like suggesting on the basis of the traditional accounts of the Holocaust and the Second World War, that you're not going to go and live in Poland because Poland is a place that genocide took place in just 25 years ago. And lots of people will have visited Poland in the 25 years following the Second World War, would have visited Germany, would have visited other countries in Europe, and would have not expected that the alleged genocides that took place in Europe during the Second World War would have been visited upon them again. And so it's just speculation, and it's not speculation, it's just over exaggeration of the threat, if any, that is actually posed by people being sent to Rwanda. And the point is that a lot of the people who are coming over to Britain in boats are people who are from Africa themselves. And so by sending them to Rwanda and by allowing them to go through an immigration process there and eventually settling in Rwanda would be like taking them out of a country, an African country, which is war-torn and where there is actually persecution and perhaps genocide taking place, and taking them to another African country where there no longer is war and there no longer is genocide taking place, and setting them somewhere where they can make a life and make a better life for their family. And so I think that the Rwanda suggestion is entirely suitable. It's far more suitable than settling people in a country which is predominantly populated by people who are of an entirely different ethnicity to the migrants, and who've got entirely different cultural traditions, which will make them feel uncomfortable once they've come and settled. And so it seems to me to be an entirely sensible arrangement.
Yeah, well, I think you're quite right there. I mean, you would want to be with people that had the same culture as you, people that were similar to you. I mean, the only problem that there is if they're economic migrants, which is, of course, what they're not supposed to be. I mean, this is the allegation that 80% of the people claiming asylum are really just economic migrants. And if that was not so, and they were genuinely looking for relief from war, and as you say, the majority of them are African anyway, then surely they're going to be better off in an African country than in a country with a completely different culture. I mean, this really does show that the people that are refusing to go along with it, they're really just keen to get more economic migrants into Britain. They're just, and I don't really understand why this is. I mean, they sort of virtue signal that it's all out of sympathy for them and it's all out of human rights for them. But surely if you were really concerned about them, you would think that they would be better off amongst their own people. Everybody is better off amongst their own people. I mean, you end up producing, I forget the name of it, there's a hormone that you produce when you're among your own people that makes you want to be sociable, and is the same hormone that's produced between a baby and its mother when the baby is breastfeeding. And when you're amongst other peoples, when you're in multiculturalism, your body doesn't produce this hormone. I mean, it's not conducive to being sociable and forming communities. So that the best place for people to be is among their own people. And if they're in Rwanda, they'll be under British law, I should imagine, when they're in this holding centre, when they're in this hotel, and then they will be able to take part in building up Rwanda. I mean, it's ideal, really. Even if they are economic migrants and they're of a pioneering mindset, then surely they would much rather be going to a new country, or a fairly new country that has plenty of resources there, and build that country up from scratch. I mean, it's a great idea, really. If you really wanted to start out from scratch and build everything anew, then you would want to go to a country in the third world. And you would also know that country is getting lots of money from Britain to help it develop. And you could help it develop, and you could build up businesses there and have a good life there. And of course, it's going to be much more value for money for Britain to be putting people there, because it's a much cheaper way of life there, isn't it? They're not going to be paying out the amount that they would pay for hotels in Britain, paying for a holding centre in Africa. It just seems really, yeah, really sensible to me. That's the thing, though. Will the British government actually do this? Because they are getting a lot of knockback. As you say, Max, there are civil servants that are resigning. The UN have said this is not on. All these human rights lawyers are saying that this is terrible. This can't possibly go on. And yet Boris and Priti Patel, they do seem keen to do it. But they have come out with other ideas in the past, haven't they? They were going to turn the boats back, weren't they? They were going to have people on jet skis that were going to be yes, turning these dinghies around. And they didn't do that. Do you think they'll go through with it?
Well, the point is, as far as human rights lawyers are concerned, they would say that it's an unworkable scheme and that it's iniquitous, because to do anything else would be to undermine the their own business, in effect. And it's good business for them if there are people who are wrangling over whether or not they're being properly treated by the immigration process. And so it's only to be expected that the human rights lawyers won't like any idea that's effective, other than allowing unlimited numbers of people to come and settle in this country. I digressed slightly there, and I've lost the question you actually asked. What was the question you asked me?
Yeah, well, I'm just sort of wondering whether you think they will actually go through with it. I say Mark doesn't think they'll go through with it. I'm half and half. I think they might go through with it, but then again, they might not. I mean, are we naive to think that they will actually go through with this plan when they've come out with all these plans before, and then they're like, oh no, we can't possibly do that. There's this loophole, so we can't do this. So I'm just...
Well, I would say there is quite a high likelihood that the government won't actually go through with it, just purely because of the lack of backbone that exists in most politicians nowadays. And if you've got human rights lawyers and you've got the pro-immigration lobby all campaigning against you, then there will be a number of politicians that will just roll over and acquiesce to the will of those people who want to create a multicultural society in Britain. As you say, it remains to be seen. I hope that the government do have the courage to go through with it. I suspect we're probably going to be somewhere half and half, where what will be implemented will be a watered down version of it eventually. And once there's a change of government and it's looking increasingly like there may be a change of government, and we may have a Labour government in the not too distant future, that I think under a Labour government that scheme will be shelved pretty quickly.
Yeah, just one final point there. I think it's going to be a benefit to the people that are coming over, because they get their safety and they get their asylum. It's a benefit to the British people, because we don't have to put up with the fake asylum seekers breaking into the country. And it's going to be a benefit to the people in Rwanda who are going to be getting all these funds. When I did first hear about it, I thought they would just be holding them there, processing their applications. The 80% that were economic migrants would be sent back to wherever they came from. And the 20% that did have a genuine asylum claim, I thought they were going to be allowed into Britain. But no, the ones with the genuine asylum claims, they will be set up with a new life in Rwanda. So, I mean, it's perfect. It sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? And of course, what we have going on here in Britain at the moment, we have this Partygate thing. We have Boris Johnson, who's been found guilty of having a few drinks with his staff after work in number 10 Downing Street. And it all just seems really ridiculous to me. The press are screaming about it. They keep having these talk shows on the television with people calling up, and their parent died in hospital, or their grandparent died in hospital, and as if it's Boris Johnson's fault and he should step down, when to me it just seems as if he's the equivalent of a parking offence, isn't it? He's been given a £50 fine, and the Labour Party are saying that he's broken the law, he must step down, he's lied to Parliament, it's the most dreadful thing that's ever happened, and it's a resigning offence. But it is essentially just the equivalent of a parking ticket. I'm sure there has been politicians that have parked on single yellow lines before, or parked in the wrong place, and nobody's thought anything of it. It just seems to me that it's really not that serious. I understand people would have been upset that they weren't able to go into hospital and what have you, but the fact is, I mean, it was his place of work, wasn't it? And the people that were turning up there for the party or whatever, they're all the people that he'd just been working with during the day. They were just sort of having a few drinks at the end of it. I think it's just really a means to bash Boris, and I'm not a big fan of Boris Johnson, and I don't really want to be standing up for him. But I do think this is a bit much, and I think it plays in his favour, to be honest, when he says, "Yes, I admit it. I've paid the £50 fine." It just sounds so ridiculous that they're making such a fuss about this. But yeah, it's all in the news. What are your thoughts on this Partygate, Max?
I think a lot of the the upset and the anger that's felt by people, which I think is actually justified because, you know, that a lot of people were prevented from going and visiting their dying relatives effectively. And I know that I would be extremely annoyed if anybody tried to stop me visiting a dying relative on their deathbed. I think, though, that some of the anger, though, is anger that felt by those people at the fact that they allowed themselves to be duped into not going and visiting their relatives on their deathbed. Because I can remember saying at the time, if anybody tried to stop me going visiting my mother, for example, or my father on their deathbed, then they would have a real fight on their hands. But a lot of people, because of the great amount of hoo-ha that there was about the pandemic at the time, a lot of people allowed themselves to be bullied effectively and browbeaten into doing something that quite obviously nobody really should have forced them to do. And it was argued at the time that no, you know, if the person who wants to go and visit somebody in the home hasn't got COVID, if they've taken a test and they've tested negative, the person they're going to visit is inside the home, they've taken a test and they've tested negative, but they're just dying of old age or whatever, then no harm is done by allowing one person to go in and visit. And the argument, the people who were running the care homes, etc., and the hospitals at the time, they should have had the courage to apply that common sense solution. So I think that a lot of the anger that's felt is felt by people because they feel that they were duped into not pressing harder to be able to go and see their relatives in hospital. I think a lot of the anger that they feel towards the government really should be directed towards the people who were the administrators of the hospitals and the homes concerned, who didn't apply a common sense solution to a very human problem. It's a source, I would imagine, of great sadness for a lot of people, what's happened there. I think that one of the things that's very often raised is that it's one rule for them and another rule for everybody else. And what people should have realized, and I've mentioned this before on a previous one of these podcasts, that during the Second World War, Winston Churchill paraded around Britain, going to visit all sorts of places as he was flag waving and in order to boost morale, with a 30-pound Havana cigar in his hand, puffing away on that, and very often was seen with a generous measure of whiskey in the other hand on social occasions. And yet those same things would have been rationed or would have been almost impossible to obtain by the vast majority of people in the country. When you look through records of the rationing that existed during the Second World War, the diet that most British people lived on during most of the Second World War was a diet which actually prevented them from getting fat. And in fact, if you look back through photographs of people during the 1940s here in Britain, there were very few people that are fat. The only fat people you ever see are politicians, and the politicians were fat because the politicians weren't subject to the same restrictions, particularly the politicians that were in the cabinet weren't subject to the same restrictions as the rest of the population. You know, we would be fools to think that Winston Churchill was restricted himself to a few ounces of dried egg powder instead of having proper eggs for his breakfast. You know, there always has been one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. It's naive for us to have expected anything else. And while we're on the subject of one rule for them and another rule for everybody else, I'm not saying that one rule for them and one rule for everybody else is correct. You can still be angry about it, but it's just naive not to expect that that's going to happen. And people, when they weren't allowed to go and visit their relatives in hospital, they should have realized that there would have been a different rule had it been a cabinet minister's mother that was dying in hospital, that cabinet minister would have been allowed to go and visit their mother or their father who was dying. People in Britain should have realised that at the time, and they should have pressed harder and not been so willing to be bullied and to be dominated by our government, effectively. And as I say, whilst on the subject of one rule for them and another rule for everybody else, within the next 10 years, it's going to become impossible to buy a new car that other than an electric car, because it's felt that that's needed in order to save the planet. Houses are rated according to their insulation properties. And properties that have got high insulation property, houses that have got high insulation properties are valued more highly than those that don't, in order that we can help to save the planet, save electricity to help save the planet. People are paying higher prices for their petrol. The government I think they've recently restarted it again as a result of the Ukraine war, but prior to the Ukraine war, we're running down the natural gas and the oil exploration that otherwise would have taken place in the North Sea in order that we would reduce our carbon footprint in order to save the planet. And yet we hear today that Rishi Sunak, who has left 11 Downing Street and decided he wants to go and live in his own private residence, has moved into, it is reported in the newspapers, a mansion that's worth £6.6 million. And the thing that has been focused on by those people reporting this is that this mansion apparently includes a heated outdoor swimming pool, which to me seems like a feature that's going to use up a tremendous amount of electricity or gas or something else, whatever is required to heat it. And it would seem to me to be wrong that not just Rishi Sunak, but anybody else who's rich should be able to have an enormous mansion with an outdoor swimming pool that's a heated outdoor swimming pool at a time when we're having to cut our cloth to suit our suit this drive to save the planet, and that again is something that I think government should look at. You know, where people who are fabulously rich squander money just purely because of their wealth. This should be looked into, because one of the allegations that's made about this swimming pool is that it's going to cost something like the equivalent of heating five houses. If the swimming pool was to be heated each day in order to be used as an outdoor swimming pool, even during cold weather. Now, whether that's true or not, it's certainly going to be true that an outdoor heated swimming pool is going to use up a fair amount of electricity. And we have to ask ourselves, should there be one rule for the rich and another rule for the poor?
Well, I think what his answer to that would probably be, well, I'm paying the same costs on the electricity, because I know on the electricity they put a green tax on it, don't they? So everybody's paying an extra 1 or 2 pence on a unit, which is supposedly going towards environmentally friendly schemes. And I guess he would say, well, however many thousands it's going to cost in electricity, I will be paying a certain amount of that will be going towards this. And I do think with Rishi Sunak, they do seem to be really going after him. It does seem to me as if it's just that they want to try and get people to not like people that have got lots of money. Basically, they don't like him because he's got lots of money. They liked him when he was giving out loads to people during the lockdown with furlough. But now they're going on about his wife and how she's got the non-dom status and therefore she's not paying the tax. Well, everybody does their best to try and avoid tax. And if it's in the law that's what she can do, then that's what she can do. And if he's got the money and he can afford to do that and he can afford to pay the extra electricity bills, then he's going to do that. I mean, obviously it doesn't look very good if he's somebody that speaks up and tries to tell everybody else that they've got to not use so much electricity. But then I dare say he could just say, yes, well, I just rewilded a forest with a donation to compensate for it. I mean, that's the awkward thing with all these carbon credits, isn't it? They just still think that they can jet around the world and do everything that they like, and they'll just donate some money towards some environmentally friendly scheme. But I do think they're going after Rishi Sunak rather a lot. And I wonder why, because they were putting him forward as a replacement for Boris Johnson recently, weren't they? But they seem to have turned on Rishi for some reason. Why do you think it is they've turned on him?
Should you be able to clock up environmental credits by planting a bit of woodland or something of that sort, and still be allowed to squander electricity on other things, you know, and that's something which again is only available to the very wealthy, because you know, if I planted a few fruit trees in my back garden, that wouldn't enable me to then continue to drive a petrol driven car in a few years' time, and so the fact of the matter is that, you know, too often there is one rule for them and a rule for everybody else. And I think that people need to take a more mature look at these kind of issues and expect, because the political system in this country is rotten to the core. And we should expect that there always is going to be one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. Obviously, we should fight against it, but we should set out with the expectation that double standard is going to exist right from the very beginning, and work towards eliminating the double standard rather than accepting the law the way it is and then moaning sometime later or complaining sometime later about the fact that a double standard existed and you weren't wealthy enough to have benefited from the double standard and somebody else was.
Well, it does seem obscene, doesn't it, really? I mean, to be doing that when everybody else is being told that they've got to have smart meters. And I think I saw something on the news recently. One country wasn't allowed to have air conditioning after 25 degrees. I mean, it may have been Ireland. But they're putting smart meters in people's homes now, which will regulate the thermostat for you. And then you've got him who can just afford to put this swimming pool there. So I do agree that it is obscene, and it will rub the public up the wrong way. He does seem to be wrong-footing himself somewhat recently, and that's what I don't understand, because he was a real darling of the press. They did really like Rishi Sunak last year, but now he seems to be targeted rather a lot by them. And alongside Boris Johnson with this Partygate thing. And you were mentioning something about Boris Johnson rubbing Russia up the wrong way, and something to do with NATO as well that you wanted to bring up, Max. Do you want to go into that?
Well, it's just that Boris Johnson is very vocally supporting Ukraine and trying to take a position front and center, I think, is the phrase that was used by Emmanuel Macron for describing the way in which Boris Johnson has kind of elbowed himself to the front of the pack when it comes to supplying Ukraine with weapons in the war against Russia. I don't want to get into here an argument about whether or not whose side we should have sympathy with in the war between Russia and Ukraine. But the position taken by NATO at the moment, which is that despite the fact that they invited Ukraine to join NATO during the George W. Bush presidency, they have chosen not to give wholehearted support and to commit troops on the ground, etc., in order to defend the Ukraine, through fear that by doing so it would trigger a third world war and it would trigger a nuclear exchange from Russia. And there have been some comments recently in the press that what's going on in the Ukraine and the position taken by NATO is effectively signalling to every other country in the world that unless you've got nuclear weapons, you are going to be vulnerable, because if you haven't got your own nuclear deterrent, then you can't expect anybody else to come to your defence if the person who's attacking you has got a nuclear weapon.
Well, I think
the only way of deterring somebody from attacking you who's got a nuclear weapon is to have a nuclear weapon yourself. And this is why countries like North Korea and the Iran and other countries that are struggling to develop nuclear weapons themselves, so that they can withstand attack by larger countries.
That's what I was going to bring up. I mean, North Korea understand this very well. That's why they wouldn't give up their nuclear weapons. Libya did give up its nuclear weapons, and it was invaded straight away, and Gaddafi was toppled. So you can understand why these countries want to have them. Go on.
At the point of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Ukraine had nuclear weapons, but they gave up their nuclear weapons based upon assurances provided by Russia and the United States and Britain that they would come to Ukraine's defence if Ukraine was ever attacked. And yet, NATO aside, Britain and the United States haven't stepped in to help defend the Ukraine when the Ukraine has been attacked by one of the countries that actually was saying that they would secure Ukraine's sovereignty. That's the word, yes, to secure their sovereignty. And so at the moment, any small country that is relying upon a larger country or a more wealthy country that's got nuclear weapons really should will logically be thinking, perhaps should we have nuclear weapons? And even countries like Britain, who've got a nuclear deterrent, but a nuclear deterrent that is entirely dependent upon the United States of America, if Britain was attacked, the Americans might adopt the same position that, Britain's been attacked and perhaps been attacked with nuclear weapons, but we're not going to challenge the country that's fired nuclear weapons at Britain because we don't want to trigger a nuclear exchange and perhaps have 80% of the United States of America devastated as a result of that. And they may turn around to us when we attempt to retaliate with our own nuclear weapons of not allowing us to use our nuclear weapons. I wonder how much control over the nuclear deterrent that is nominally in the hands of the British Armed Forces is actually entirely in the hands of the British Armed Forces, and whether or not we could actually retaliate unilaterally in a situation where we're attacked if the United States didn't want to come to our aid and didn't want to actually support us in that conflict.
Yeah, that's a good point there about Britain and America and Russia guaranteeing Ukraine's defence and then Russia going in there. So why haven't Britain and America gone in there and kept up their side of the bargain? I mean, that's obviously why there's this implication that America and Britain should be helping somehow in Ukraine. Because I thought, well, just because Ukraine wants to be a member of NATO, there's no reason why we should be helping them. But if there was a pact there, then the fact that Russia is a nuclear power, that's obviously the reason why not. So I mean, it does encourage people or encourages countries rather to get nuclear weapons rather, doesn't it? Well, do you have anything else you want to add to that, Max, or shall we get into Greater Britain?
I was just going to say that there are a number of countries that have become concerned by this, and the report that I read did suggest that Japan might be a country that might now start to push to develop its own nuclear weapons because Japan is under threat from both China and Russia. There are some of the northern islands of Japan have been occupied by Russia in recent years, and the Japanese have asked for the islands back, and the Russians have just said no, they are part of Russia. And we've got a situation where North Korea has been firing missiles over Japan in order to intimidate the Japanese, in order to intimidate South Koreans. And so the South Koreans will be another country that should have the sort of technology where they could develop nuclear weapons. And so will we have them developing their own nuclear weapons for fear that they can't rely on the Americans any longer, and will Taiwan do the same thing? And so it just creates this great problem. I'm not necessarily suggesting that we ought to initially dive into a war against Russia. But what I think needs to happen is there needs to be a lot more hard talking between, by the leaders of countries in order to deter Russia from using the threat of nuclear weapons, because the Russia Putin has and a number of Russian generals, etc., have made have inferred that they may decide to use nuclear weapons at some point. And there's been this new missile that's been tested, which a Russian general went out of his way to state would enable them to hit Britain just within an hour of launch. And so, we could be heading into a situation which is rather like the Cold War that existed back when I was a boy, when it was quite common for newspapers to have entire pages devoted to how to build a nuclear bomb shelter in your back garden. We are almost back at that that point again, and it seems to be that our Prime Minister seems to be oblivious of the threat that he is creating for us as a country by being seen to be the front runner and by being seen to be elbowing Macron out of the way in order to be seen as the glory boy who's doing the most to help the Ukraine. That the leaders of the West haven't thought this through, and we do need to think to think seriously about the threat that is posed to Britain today by our government's involvement in the Ukraine, and not just. Not just that one issue, but to think about what might happen in the future where another state that's got nuclear weapons does something which our government doesn't like, and then threatens to fire nuclear missiles at us again. We need to, as a civil defence, from a civil defence perspective, we need to start thinking about whether we should start to build bunkers in our back gardens to defend ourselves in the event of a nuclear war.
It just shows you how important defence is. And as you say, talking is what we need. We need more talking, but they keep trying to deter these talks. So at least that's what Russia is saying, is that Ukraine is just stalling when they try to have these peace talks. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth I, our Greatest Briton for this week. Last episode, we heard how she managed to keep the country Protestant while preventing any major troubles with the Catholics. This upset the Pope, who excommunicated anyone who obeyed their oath to her. Despite this, she stepped in to soften the legislation made against the Catholics, and they repaid her by trying to put Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne, who ended up being beheaded for making one too many attempts at it. And that was basically through marriage. She kept marrying people with a claim to the English throne. Sir Francis Drake defeated the Spanish Armada for her, and she made alliances with other countries against Spain, even making allies out of the Ottomans. And I think that that friendship lasted for another 100 years or so. She failed to make friends in Ireland, though, allowing thousands to starve to death, and trying militarily to prevent the country from being used as a springboard for the Catholics to attack England. And in this episode, we will finally get to her response to complaints that England was becoming multicultural. Do you have anything you'd like to add to that, Max?
Just that it sets the scene, really, with regard to the troubles in Northern Ireland, really, and you can see from this period in history the seeds of discontent between the Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants that continued to bubble away under the surface all the way through to more recent times.
Yeah, it's been interesting to find out the history of Ireland as well as we're going along through this, and the way that the English kings treated them. They always treated them in a really bad way. But getting on to relations with America, in 1583, Sir Humphrey Gilbert sailed west to establish a colony on Newfoundland, and he never returned to England. Gilbert's relative, Sir Walter Raleigh, explored the Atlantic coast and claimed the territory of Virginia, perhaps named in honour of Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. The territory was much larger than the present-day state of Virginia, extending from New England to the Carolinas. In 1585, Raleigh returned to Virginia with a small group of people and they landed on the island of Roanoke, off present-day North Carolina. After the failure of the first colony, Raleigh recruited another group and put John White in command. When Raleigh returned in 1590, there was no trace of the Roanoke colony he had left, but it was the first English settlement in North America. So it was under Queen Elizabeth that we really started to set up colonies in America round about this time. And it retained its English flavour, always has done, because English has been the language that was spoken there. But I don't think the American ethnicity really sort of came in until the last century. You had people that spoke German over there. You had people that spoke English over there. It was mainly North Europeans, and then there was South Europeans, and there was prejudice against the Irish again. There's always been this this Irish question, this issue with the Irish that was going on back then. And as you say, it really started with I think it started with Cromwell before Elizabeth, but then it continued with the treatment that Ireland was given by these monarchs. Do you know much about this time, the settlement of America and Walter Raleigh, Max?
I'm not particularly knowledgeable, no. But yes, as you say, the settlement of North America was primarily by British people, effectively, initially, which is why parts of North America are called New England, etc. There were lots of places in the eastern seaboard of North America that have got the title New something, like New York, for example, and this is as a result of the people going over there to make a new European civilization, a new civilization such as the one that they'd left behind.
You know, I wonder if the first time we put new before anything was New Troy, you know, the earliest name for London, Troy Nova, and the Trinovantes were the people from there, and it was New Troy, basically, and that was the history at this time. Everybody understood that that was the history of Britain. We actually came from the Trojans, so I think that maybe it was in homage to that that they actually named it Newfoundland, New England, New York. You know, it's taken from that New Troy, which was basically the name for the city of London originally. Let's have a look at India here as well. The East India Company was formed to trade in the Indian Ocean region and China and received its charter from Queen Elizabeth on 31st of December 1600. For a period of 15 years, the company was awarded a monopoly on English trade with all countries east of the Cape of Good Hope and west of the Straits of Magellan. Sir James Lancaster commanded the first expedition in 1601, and the company would eventually control half the world's trade and have substantial territory in India in the 18th and the 19th centuries. I think it would go on to be as powerful as like a parallel government, wasn't it? In fact, the British government were the puppets of the East India Company for a long time. So this was a very important period when you think about it, discovering America, the East India Company being formed, Britain moving out there into India, and this company had a monopoly on all English trade, and half the trade in the world was controlled by it by the 18th and the 19th centuries.
An amazing statistic.
I like it when we do the British Empire stuff. Hopefully we'll get into more of that later in the year. Well, now we'll talk about the Blackamoors. In 1596, Queen Elizabeth issued an open letter to the Lord Mayor of London, announcing that, quote, "There are of late diverse blackamoors brought into this realm, of which kind of people there are already here too many, and ordering that they be deported from the country." And we have these actual documents from the National Archive, which I will quote here. "An open letter to the Lord Mayor of London and the aldermen, his brethren, and to all the other mayors and sheriffs. It is Her Majesty's understanding that there are of late diverse blackamoors brought into the realm, of which kind of people there are already too many. Considering how God hath blessed this land with great increase of people of our own nation, as any country in the world, whereof many, for want of service and means to set them to work, fall to idleness and to great extremity. Her Majesty's pleasure is therefore this, that those kind of people should be sent forth out of the land. And for that purpose there is direction given to this bearer, Edward Baines, to take of those blackamoors, that in this last voyage under Sir Thomas Baskerville were brought into this realm, to the number of 10, to be transported by him out of the realm, wherein we require you to be aiding and assisting unto him as he shall have occasion, and therefore not to fail. And I think what she's saying here is that the white people in Britain, some of them were not in work, and they were falling to idleness and to great extremity. And the concern was that these blackamoors, they were being put to work in instead. And this is interesting, because the blackamoors were actually slaves. So it's saying that to be a slave, that the white people, they wanted to be slaves, because if they were slaves, everything was paid for. They had their food and the rest of it paid for. If they weren't employed, if they weren't in slavery, they would fall to idleness and to great extremity. And yet the narrative today is that these blackamoors, that they were slaves and they were mistreated. And yet these letters from the Queen make it clear that they weren't being mistreated, and that they were actually in a higher up position than some of the Queen's subjects, which is what she was concerned about. Is there anything you want to pick up on in this particular quote, Max?
Only that it's a very important quotation, and the existence of these letters is very important, because it does show and it does counter the claim that there have always been lots of people of non-white origin in this country, and so. One thing that we can be fairly sure of is that the vast majority of people of non-European extraction living in Britain at that particular time were probably expelled from the country.
Well, I think they were expelled. I mean, they'll try and say today that they weren't, but I mean, it's the Queen's order. She said that they need to be expelled. And it's like, it also shows that she has an understanding of our nation. She has an understanding of her ethnicity, and that these people are from a different ethnicity, as well as being from a different country. She talks about nation and country as two different things here. Or 1 week later, she reiterated her good pleasure to have those kind of people sent out of the land, and she commissioned the merchant Caspar van Senden to take up certain blackamoors here in this realm and to transport them into Spain and Portugal. And we have the full letter here. An open warrant to the Lord Mayor of London and to all other vice admirals, mayors, and other public officers whatsoever to whom it may appertain. Whereas Caspar van Senden, a merchant of Lubeck, did by his labour and travel procure 89 of Her Majesty's subjects that were detained prisoners in Spain and Portugal to be released, and brought them hither into this realm at his own cost and charges, for the which his expenses were refunded, and a declaration of his honest mind towards those prisoners was made, he desireth to have license to take up so many blackamoors that are here in this realm, and to transport them into Spain and Portugal. Her Majesty, with regards to the charitable affection the suppliant hath shown, since him being a stranger did work to achieve the delivery of our countrymen that were in great misery and thraldom, and to bring them home to their native country, and that same could not be done without great expense, Her Majesty considers his request to transport so many blackamoors from hence to be reasonable. So I'll just stop there. So we've got this merchant of Lubeck who is not actually British or English, and he, by his own labour, he's travelled and he has released 89 of Her Majesty's subjects that have been captured. So I guess they were captives in Spain and Portugal. And his reward for this, he's been refunded, but he's now also saying, well, can I go back to Spain and I will take back these blackamoors that you've decided that you don't actually want in the kingdom here. So it wasn't the blackamoors that he brought into Britain. He brought into Britain these captives. And we heard that there was war with Spain at the time with the Armada, so that's what that was to do. I mean, when I first read it, I wondered if they were slaves, but it says here that they were in thraldom, and I guess that's what slaves would have been called at that time, thralls. Yes. Any comments on that, Max?
Yeah, just again, just to say that you know, all this shows that from this particular point forward in British history, the number of people who were the number of non-whites living in Britain would have been extremely small, and that there've been a number of historical or like period dramas that have been begun to be shown, particularly on ITV, I've noticed, where they show people during the Georgian period, where there are very large numbers of black people portrayed. There was an interview that I saw by a black actress, who claimed that her mother had done lots of research which showed that there were indeed these proportions of non-white people living in London at the time, and these letters of Queen Elizabeth I actually show that that isn't true at all, and that as I've said, there would have been very, very few non-white people living in Britain at the time.
Well, I think their argument is, oh, there's no proof that these letters, you know, these commands were carried out. That they're commands from the Queen. Of course they were carried out. You know, you wouldn't disobey the Queen. And yet they say, oh, we don't have records of the ships that left, but we have these letters of her giving these commands. Continuing with this particular one, she says, I doth think it a very good exchange, and that those kind of people may well be spared in this realm, being so populous with numbers of able persons that are the subjects of this land, that are Christian people, but that perish for want of service, whereby through their labour they might be maintained. The public officer are therefore in their lordship's name required to aid and assist him to take up such blackamoors as he shall find within this realm, with consent of their masters, who we doubt not, considering Her Majesty's good pleasure, will wish to have those kinds of people out of the land, and the good deserving of the stranger being turned towards Her Majesty's subjects, and they shall do charitable and like Christians, and rather to be served by their own countrymen than with those kinds of people, will yield those in their possession to him. So she's saying that her subjects are perishing for want of work, and if they could only get work, they could be maintained, and yet there are some people that are employing these blackamoors. So and with the, today, non-whites will tell us that these blackamoors were slaves. So it's saying that the subjects, the Queen's subjects, wanted to be slaves. They wanted to be in slavery because that meant that they had service, and by their labour they might be maintained, and that was the reward for being a slave. You were maintained. And it says here, with the consent of their masters, because this is the Queen's will, so of course their masters are going to want to do that. And she's saying that charity should be towards your own. The good deserving of the stranger needs to be turned towards Her Majesty's subjects, and they need to do charitable and be like Christians and be served by their own countrymen than by be served by other countrymen from somewhere else. I think it's quite illuminating in lots of different ways, I think, Max. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm just trying to look back through the text here to find, but that the statement you read out said that Her Majesty requires this to be done. And so that's right. Therefore, in their lordship's name, required to aid and assist him to take up such blackamoors as he shall find within this realm. So, the other notables and people in positions of responsibility were required by the Queen to do that, and so therefore, in my view, that's as you say, a requirement of the Queen, and so therefore, that would be something that would have been done.
Yeah, it had to be done. It's like a law, a proclamation. Finally, in 1601, she complained again about the great numbers of Negroes and Blackamoors, which, as she is informed, are crept into this realm, defamed them as infidels, having no understanding of Christ or his gospel, and again authorized their deportation. And this is from the License to Deport Black People, Tudor Royal Proclamations, Volume 3, page 221 to 222. So this is a royal proclamation here. whereas the Queen's Majesty, tendering the good and welfare of her own natural subjects, who are greatly distressed in these hard times of dearth, is highly discontented to understand the great number of Negroes and Blackamoors which, as she is informed, are carried into this realm since the troubles between Her Highness and the King of Spain. They have been fostered and empowered here to the great annoyance of her own liege people, which do require the relief which these people consume. Also for the reason that most of them are infidels, having no understanding of Christ or his gospel, Her Majesty hath given a special commandment that the said kind of people shall with all speed be voided and discharged out of this Her Majesty's realm. And to that purpose hath appointed Caspar van Senden, merchant of Lubeck, for their speedy transportation, a man that hath somewhat deserved of this realm respect, in that by his own labour and charge he hath relieved and brought out from Spain many of our English nation who otherwise would have perished there. Therefore we will that you all be required to aid and assist the said Caspar van Senden, or his assignees, in taking such Negroes and Blackamoors to be transported as aforesaid, as he shall find them, within the realm of England. And if there shall be any persons or person which be possessed of any such Blackamoor that refuse to deliver them in the sort aforesaid, then we require of you to call them before you, and to advise and persuade them by all good means to satisfy Her Majesty's pleasure therein. And if they shall wilfully and obstinately refuse, we pray you to certify their names to us, to the end that Her Majesty may take such further course therein as it shall seem best in her princely wisdom. So she's very serious about this. This is a royal proclamation. And again, we see that they are taking up the resources which her own people need. And it's yes. just a wonder that they're there. She's saying that they're there because of the troubles between England and Spain. So I'm wondering what the troubles were that caused the Blackamoors to be transported to Britain, where they were then employed on estates. Perhaps it was people that were her subjects that were originally in Spain that moved back here and brought them back with them. But certainly all of them would have been sent back to Spain and Portugal here, I think. There's no way that her commands would not have been obeyed, and there would have been punishment if they didn't. And she also just seems very, you know, she's not cracking the whip, is she? The way that it's put there. She's being very charitable, very kind, the way that she's saying this. She's not threatening them. She's, you know, the threat there is we'll take such further course as shall seem best in her princely wisdom. You know, not that they'll be hung, drawn and quartered if they don't obey the king.
You know, she's very assertive, but insistent nonetheless.
Diplomatic, isn't she? She's diplomatic there. Well, rather than get on to some of these other bits, I think we should probably leave that there. So we have another episode on Queen Elizabeth, I think, Max. So we'll leave that there. Okay. So thank you very much for coming on today.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope that you have a great week ahead of you.